In addition, the amorphousness of the ROE allowed troops to invent almost any rationale to justify killing. From a bouncy gate, those shuffling farmers don't have a gate like that, said one pilot, to killing people for the sin of running, as the historian David Hunt termed it. One advisor in the Mekong Delta surveyed forward air control pilots and helicopter crews about such acts. Their standard reply is this: if you take evasive action, you are guilty, he wrote in an official report. It takes extreme courage to stand in the middle of a rice paddy when a Cobra helicopter gunship buzzes you. If you live in an area that is frequented by these operations, your first instinctive reaction is to clear out and get into the nearest bunker. In many instances, as in the case of the woodcutters in Binh Long, troops took measures that frightened Vietnamese into running and then treated them as legitimate targets. William Patterson, who had served as a helicopter door gunner in the region outside of Saigon, told Army criminal investigators how he'd been instructed. If we ran across unarmed people that appeared to be civilians, I was to fire as near to them as possible. If they ran, I had permission to kill them. Wen Thi Lam, a villager from the Mekong Delta, described to me the effect of these policies as seen from the other end of the machine gun. On the morning of May 20, 1968, she was out working in the rice paddies near her home when she and her fellow farmers heard the roar of approaching helicopters. Fearing for their lives, they ran for cover. One of the choppers then opened fire, pouring bullets down at them. A round tore through her sister-in-law's throat, killing her on the spot. As Lam dove to the ground, another bullet ripped through her left leg, and she blacked out. When she came to, an American was standing over her. He took her to a U.S. hospital for medical treatment, but she lost the leg. Perhaps the purest expression of the effect of the rules of engagement I ever found was on the death certificate of Nguyen Mai, an unarmed Vietnamese man who died from a penetrating wound to the face. The official military paperwork in the U.S. National Archives was written up by an American medical officer. Sparse in its details, Nguyen's date of birth, marital status, religion, and next of kin are all missing. The certificate does, however, list the official external cause of death: running from U.S. forces. As ill-defined and porous as the rules of engagement were, they still at least nominally required troops to distinguish civilians from combatants. Another command concept, though, did away with that distinction altogether in much of the country: the notion of the free fire or free strike zone, a label given to areas where everyone was assumed to be the enemy. Later, the name would be changed for public relations reasons to specified strike zone, but the meaning remained the same. In free fire zones, an infantryman later recalled, everyone, men, women, children, could be considered a fair target. You could not be held responsible for firing on innocent civilians since, by definition, there were none there. The effects were ruinous for the Vietnamese. On April 15, 1970, for instance, members of Company B, 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, asked their company commander whether there were any friendlies in the hamlet of Le Bac. As Sergeant Paul Cox recalled, the commander replied, "No, this is a free fire zone." Immediately, there was shooting. The first hut I got to, there was an old mama-san lying in the middle of the floor, gut shot. She was dying, Cox told me years later. At the next hut, a small group of elderly villagers and mothers with children had been gunned down. Nearby, he saw yet another similar scene. Inside the hamlet, a young girl named Ho Ti A watched in terror as the carnage unfolded. There were three of us standing at the entrance to the bunker, me and two old women, my neighbor and my grandmother, she told me. The three had just scrambled out of their earthen bomb shelter when an American took aim and shot the two elderly women, one after the other. Ho Ti A wheeled around and clambered back into the bunker, cowering there as the Americans tossed in grenades after her. She later emerged to find that a total of 15 villagers had been killed in Le Bac that day. All of the victims, she and other survivors from the hamlet told me, were civilians. The free fire label was not quite an unlimited license to kill, since the laws of war still apply to these areas. As the military legal expert and former Marine prosecutor Gary Solis noted, a free fire zone doesn't mean a free crime zone. Just because it's a free fire zone doesn't mean you can go in and shoot whoever you run into. But many American soldiers did not make that subtle distinction. Even a U.S. Senate study acknowledged that by 1968, an estimated 300,000 civilians had been killed or wounded in free fire zones. The horrific toll was not unforeseen. In 1962, before most Americans even knew that their nation was at war in Southeast Asia, Brigadier General H.K. Eggleston was already sounding the alarm about the military's propensity for unleashing firepower on heavily populated areas. In a lessons learned memorandum, an internal report presenting knowledge gleaned in the field, he emphatically decreed, "All forms of firepower, from the carbine to the 500-pound bomb, must have positively identified VC targets." Eggleston noted that since the VC have no rear areas, no logistic bases, and no staging or cantonment areas in the generally accepted conventional sense, the application of firepower on a suspected VC area to destroy VC combat potential is of little value. Ultimately, he said, unless targets are positively identified as enemy, casualties among the people rather than the VC will result. But the warning fell on deaf ears. A year after Eggleston issued his memorandum, Westmoreland received his orders for Vietnam. Before heading to Saigon, he met to discuss the new assignment with retired General Douglas MacArthur, who had served as top commander in the Pacific during World War II, functionally ruled occupied Japan after its surrender, and commanded U.S. and Allied forces in Korea. According to Westmoreland's memoir, MacArthur urged me to make sure I always had plenty of artillery, for the Oriental, he said, greatly fears artillery, and suggested that Westmoreland might have to employ a scorched earth policy in Vietnam. As U.S. troops began to flood into the country in the mid-1960s, Eggleston's guidance quickly gave way to policies that hewed to MacArthur's advice. In September 1965, Westmoreland issued MACV Directive No. 525-3. Ostensibly concerned with minimizing non-combatant battle casualties, it actually turned vast swaths of the South Vietnamese countryside into areas where anyone and anything was fair game for U.S. firepower. Free strike zones should be configured to eliminate populated areas except those in accepted VC bases, the directive decreed, thus declaring open season on millions of Vietnamese. According to McNamara's 1964 figures, 40% of the South Vietnamese countryside was considered to be under Viet Cong control or predominant influence. Westmoreland's policy made that entire territory theoretically open to unrestrained attack. Warnings of impending strikes were supposed to be issued whenever possible, but sometimes such announcements, broadcast from loudspeakers on aircraft, could not be heard or understood. Other times, confusing leaflets would rain down on illiterate villagers. Even when warned, villagers frequently had nowhere else to go or little time to do so. Often enough, no warning came at all. Planes would simply flash across the skies, dropping high explosive bombs or napalm canisters that tumbled end over end and bloomed into enormous fiery bursts. Of course, even if ample warnings were issued, firing on villages was still a violation of the laws of war, which prohibit direct attacks on civilians. Indiscriminate as bombing and artillery fire often were in Vietnam, free fire zones took away, by definition, any need for discrimination. While serving as an assistant to Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge, Richard Holbrooke complained to both the ambassador and Westmoreland that the free fire zones were a real danger to the war effort. "There are people living down there," he complained once as the three flew over a free fire zone, only to be told, "Well, they're communist-controlled areas." Any villages declared hostile by South Vietnamese province chiefs were regarded as VC base camps, and the U.S. military officially considered every man, woman, and child in them Viet Cong supporters, if not outright Viet Cong, and thus reasonable targets. According to Pentagon figures, in January 1969 alone, airstrikes were carried out on or near hamlets where 3.3 million Vietnamese lived. Of course, peasants lived in VC base areas because their families had been there for generations. That's where their rice fields were and their ancestors' graves. Many felt so deeply rooted in the land that they couldn't imagine leaving, even when bombs and shells began to fall. And many of those who contemplated moving simply couldn't afford to leave. When one peasant who did rally to the Saigon government, moving away from a hamlet that had been almost totally destroyed by bombing and shelling, was asked why more than 100 of his fellow villagers still remained there, he explained, Most of them are poor farmers. A few of them had left the village for Saigon-controlled areas, but they had to come back since they were not able to make a living over there. Those who stayed didn't have a choice. It was this kind of poverty that made Le Thi Van's family remain in their hamlet of Nhi Binh in the Mekong Delta, even though the area was hit by mortar and artillery rounds several times a day and bombed once or twice a month. They paid a terrible price. On February 10, 1968, while Van was visiting relatives in another village, an artillery shell scored a direct hit on her family's bomb shelter. Seven of her relatives, including her pregnant sister-in-law, were instantly killed. Their corpses were so badly mutilated that when Van returned to Nhi Binh, she could identify them only by their legs. Aside from augmenting the body count statistics, free fire zones were also integral to another policy objective, driving villagers out of territory controlled by the NLF and into areas controlled by the Saigon government. These efforts were commonly known as pacification, but their true aim was to depopulate the contested countryside. "The people are like water, and the army is like fish," Mao Zedong, the leader of the Chinese Communist Revolution, had famously written. American planners grasped his dictum and also studied the kill-all, burn-all, loot-all, scorched-earth campaigns that the Japanese army launched in rural China during the 1930s and early 1940s for lessons on how to drain the sea. Not surprisingly, the idea of forcing peasants out of their villages was embraced by civilian pacification officials and military officers alike. In 1964, an American officer remarked, "We must terrorize the villagers even more so that they see their real self-interest lies with us. We've got to start bombing and strafing the villages that aren't friendly to the government." One reporter recalled an army captain in a heavily populated Mekong Delta province sweeping his hand across a couple dozen hamlets on a map and remarking that refugees were streaming out of the area. The reporter asked why. "Because it's not healthy out there," the captain replied. "We're shelling the hell out of them." U.S. commanders repeatedly denied that there was any formal policy of generating refugees, but one U.S. official admitted in 1967 that, policy or not, they're sure doing it. General William Westmoreland did, in fact, plainly state the military's thinking in a 1965 speech. "Until now, the war has been characterized by a substantial majority of the population remaining neutral. In the past year, we have seen an escalation to a higher intensity in the war. This will bring about a moment of decision for the peasant farmer. He will have to choose if he stays alive. Until now, the peasant farmer has had three alternatives. He could stay put and follow his natural instinct to stay close to the land, living beside the grave of his ancestors. He could move into an area under government control, or he could join the VC. Now, if he stays put, there are additional dangers. Our operations have been designed to make the first choice impossible." Similarly, Robert Comer, President Lyndon Johnson's special assistant for pacification, sent a cable to Deputy Ambassador William Porter in 1966 regarding military operations specifically designed to generate refugees. The next year, after being appointed as Westmoreland's deputy and the U.S. pacification chief, Comer suggested implementing a policy of stepping up refugee programs deliberately aimed at depriving the VC of a recruiting base. "In order to thwart the communists' designs," wrote Westmoreland a year later, "one had to either eliminate the fish, which was, he noted, difficult and time-consuming, or dry up the water so that the fish cannot survive." Another general was even more explicit, telling the reporter R.W. Appel, "You've got to dry up the sea the guerrillas swim in. That's the peasants, and the best way to do that is to blast the hell out of their villages so they'll come into our refugee camps." When Vietnamese abandoned their villages, they were often simply shuttled into overwhelmed, underfunded, understaffed, underprovisioned, and under-equipped concentration zones, either refugee camps or artificial villages that the refugees were sometimes forced to build themselves. These settlements, which went by many different names over the years, often made farming impossible. "I had 2 hectares of rice in the old village," one elderly man complained. "Now it is ripe, and the grain falls into the paddy mud. I cannot harvest it. There are men here with guns who tell me that we must dig a ditch. In the bottom of that ditch we must put sharpened bamboo stakes, and on each side of the ditch there must be offensive barbed wire. When it is finished, I can return to harvest my rice. But my rice will be gone then. Who will feed my family?" In 1962, the New York Times described a scene in which U.S. advisors and Allied Vietnamese troops relocated hundreds of villagers as part of Operation Sunrise. The operation's tearful title belied the fact that it involved burning the food, homes, and in some cases all the possessions of the villagers before sending them to inhospitable barracks that even the lead U.S. advisor conceded were no happy hollow. In 1969, an article in the Times would describe another village-clearing operation, this time with U.S. troops in the lead. The commanders had changed and the firepower had increased, but the procedures were much the same. 24 hours before the villages are razed, the inhabitants are warned by leaflets and loudspeaker broadcasts to leave their homes. The inhabitants are then placed in newly constructed resettlement villages, which are often enclosed by barbed wire. First, the Zippo squad set fire to the thatched dwellings with their lighters. If the town is in a free fire zone, and if the village has already been burned once before, the people who go out know that they will be dead, Sergeant Steve Court declared. If it's all a free fire zone, you can sit on the hills and see the dinks running around, so they call in big airstrikes, he said. Lieutenant Norman Cottrell added, "What we try to do is to get all the people out of the ville before we start burning. Of course, they don't want to go. That's their home and everything." Those particular troops destroyed more than a dozen villages in just 1 week. A few years later, an American aid worker described the Saigon-run refugee camps in the area as being more like concentration camps than the attractive-sounding return-to-village programs, as they are called by the government. Conditions in these camps are appalling. For those thrust into camp life, the experience was jarring. One reporter described how what had been a thriving, well-populated farming area in Quang Tri province was transformed into a landscape of burned-out houses and bomb and artillery craters after the Marines arrived, with the surviving civilian population evacuated to a resettlement area near Cam Lo. An American survey of the Cam Lo refugees showed that 54% of them had received no advance warning of their move at all, and that of those who did get warned in advance, more than half were given less than a day's notice. Nearly a quarter of the refugees lost everything they owned in the evacuation. Even after propaganda sessions with a South Vietnamese psychological warfare platoon, the villagers did not hide their displeasure from interviewers. 97% of them said their employment situation was worse than before. 95% described their resettlement house as less comfortable than their former home, and 87% said that their life situation was now worse than it had been in the war zone, where bombing, artillery strikes, and U.S. military operations were a constant threat, and where conscription and taxation by revolutionary forces were routine. Within months, thousands in the camp were facing starvation. Their situation was not unusual. Take, for instance, the experience of Quang Nam resident Nguyen Van Tam. First, aircraft dropped leaflets declaring his hamlet a free fire zone, giving the inhabitants 24 hours to evacuate. The bombing that followed forced his family into an underground existence, and one bomb killed his father as he worked in a rice paddy. A few days later, U.S. troops entered his village. They pointed to the road and said, "We must all leave," Tom recalled. "My mother cried. They took matches and burned our house. Then they shot our buffaloes. Then we began to walk to the refugee camp outside Da Nang to find shelter and food." Both would prove in short supply. Asked about special problems in refugee camps, one district chief from Quang Nam province provided a succinct list. 1. Not enough water. 2. Not enough food. 3. Not enough first aid station attendants and medical personnel. 4. No arable lands, no jobs. 5. Not enough schools. At the Hung Quang evacuee regroupment site in the same province, 95% of refugees said they were worse off in terms of employment than before their resettlement. Not far away at the Ngoc Thanh camp on the outskirts of Hoi An, 92% of residents complained that their current home was less comfortable than the one they'd had in their village. It's not hard to imagine why. A Marine described one of the province's camps as several hundred one-room tin shacks with no doors and rags over the windows for curtains, all jammed in one next to the other in tight rows on bare, hard-packed earth and surrounded by barbed wire and chain-link fencing. It reeked of squalor. Similarly, a survey team from the U.S. General Accounting Office wrote of a Quang Nam camp, During our inspection, we observed there were no latrines, no usable wells, no classrooms, and no medical facilities. The shelters were crudely constructed from a variety of waste materials, such as empty ammunition boxes and cardboard. We observed that the number of shelters would not adequately house these people. The American Refugee Advisers stated that there were no plans to improve the living conditions at this site. In October 1967, South Vietnam's Commissioner for Refugees noted that he often received only a day's warning before U.S. operations in I Corps swamped him with as many as 10,000 people at a time. Many displaced villagers were left out of official statistics, but even a U.S. Marine Corps history put the total number of refugees in I Corps that month at 539,000. 2 years later, it stood at an estimated 690,000, more than half the official count of refugees in the entire country. As the war dragged on, ever less money would be devoted to refugee aid and public health programs. In 1967, the support that the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, gave to South Vietnam's Ministry of Health topped out at $5.9 million. The agency's total medical budget in Vietnam for the year added up to 0.25% of U.S. expenditures in the country. In effect, said one analyst, an entire year's allocation equaled what was spent in less than a day on the war effort. 2 years later, USAID support for the ministry had dropped to less than $1 million. In the words of the journalist Jonathan Schell, the Americans in Vietnam liked to speak of the military half of what they were doing, but the half was in reality more like 9/10, and the other 1/10, the contribution to nation-building, was often, in the context of the war, pure mockery. For example, it frequently happened that in driving the enemy out of a village, the Americans would destroy it. That was the military half. The civilian half then might be to drop thousands of leaflets on the ruins, explaining the evils of the NLF, or perhaps introducing the villagers to some hygienic measures that the Americans thought were a good idea. U.S. and South Vietnamese officials repeatedly explained the exodus of peasants by claiming that the people were voting with their feet, fleeing VC terror, taxation, and conscription. However, both the head of the U.S. Refugee Division and South Vietnam's Refugee Commissioner admitted that most of those who fled their hamlets did so to escape bombardment and battle. A 1967 U.S. study in Kien Giang province found that nearly two-thirds of refugees cited shelling and bombing, in most cases from the United States and its allies, as their reason for fleeing. In nearby Dinh Thuong province, more than 60% of the Vietnamese surveyed blamed South Vietnamese and U.S. forces for making them leave their hamlets, while only 22% blamed the Viet Cong. Similarly, a 1970 study of refugees in Quang Nam province found that 80% of refugees whose villages had been destroyed blamed U.S. and allied forces. 18% said that the damage had happened in firefights between the two sides, and just 2% blamed the revolutionary forces alone. Just how disproportionately civilians could suffer during battles and why so many were forced to flee their homes can be seen from the events on Kỳ Hoa Island off the coast of Quang Tin Province. On July 9, 1965, when U.S. Marines fought a pitched battle against the revolutionary forces on the island, the Americans lost 3 men in the fighting, the guerrillas 6. Among the civilian population of Kỳ Hoa, however, 100 people were reportedly killed. According to their official command diary, the Marines also allegedly burned 185 homes and beat up many civilians, including a middle-aged Vietnamese woman and her 7-month-old daughter. Civilians who attempted to thwart the refugee generation system by staying in their villages often paid the price. Larry Farmer, who served with Company E of the 4th Battalion, 31st Infantry, testified about one such group of resistors in late September 1969 in the Quang Tin-Quang Nam border region. Our squad was running the Vietnamese women and children from the area, and we were burning their huts as we went to ensure they wouldn't return after we left. That day we had burned one hut in a clearing where there were 3 huts and about 15 women and children living. As we were burning the hut, I told all of the people to leave the area and go to the refugee camp. The next day, my squad returned to that same area. When we approached the clearing where we'd burned the hut, we found the same women and children. However, they had all moved into the 2 remaining huts. Finding that their orders had been disobeyed, the Americans began by shooting up a pen full of pigs. Then, according to testimony by fellow unit members, Farmer, Infantryman Alter Floyd, and several others fired on the group of women and children. "I think Floyd shot one and tore his leg off. It was just hanging there by the meat," unit member Davy Hogue said in a sworn statement. Squad leader Charles Downing remembered some of them gunning down women and young children. Michael Garcia recalled the men firing on a woman holding a baby and then turning on the infant. "They just shot the baby all up," he told Army investigators. Altogether, 9 or 10 women and children were murdered and called in as confirmed VC kills. The I Corps provinces of Quang Tin, Quang Ngai, Quang Nam, and Quang Tri in the north were not the only areas where U.S. forces deliberately attacked villages in order to force the residents into refugee camps. Such assaults happened throughout the country. In 1966, for instance, when U.S. and South Vietnamese troops first arrived in Tan Son Hamlet, a farming enclave in Binh Dinh Province in Tu Corps, many of the hamlet's young men fled. The soldiers then herded together some of the remaining villagers, beat them, and shocked them with electric cattle prods to force them to leave for a refugee center. Many other residents were brutalized or shot. Over the following years, American and South Vietnamese troops would return to Tan Son again and again, destroying rice crops and abusing, arresting, and sometimes killing residents. Pham Thi Thien told me that her home was destroyed at least 5 times during the war, a common story for villages in free fire zones. The Americans detained villagers and burned their homes because they wanted people to move to the concentration area, Thien explained to me years afterward. The leaf house burned down, the soil house emerged, became a hamlet axiom during the days of these frequent home burnings, as people were reduced to living in A-framed earthen bunkers. Helicopter gunships and artillery also extracted a gruesome toll on Tan Son residents who stayed in their ancestral hamlet. Luong Thi Oi's 12-year-old daughter was literally torn in two by an artillery shell while tending cows. Bui Sit lost 2 sons when their bunker suffered a direct hit from another artillery shell. Luong Dai's parents, 2 older brothers, a younger brother, a niece, and a nephew all died when their bunker collapsed during a U.S. bombardment. When I interviewed several hamlet residents in 2008, they came up with the names of 29 victims, but insisted there had been many more, too many to recall. Sometimes the number of dead had overwhelmed the ability of survivors to bury them, they said, and pigs and ducks started eating the corpses. Pham Thi Thien, for her part, was captured in Tan Son during a joint U.S.-South Vietnamese operation in 1967 or 1968. She was beaten, then stretched spread-eagle on the ground. A U.S. soldier interrogated her through an interpreter while water was poured into her nose and mouth, choking her. "Where are your husband and children? What are they doing?" demanded the American, who accused her of living in the hamlet in order to support the guerrillas. After undergoing this water torture, Hien was taken away to a military outpost where she was put to work filling sandbags. She spent 8 months there, and then, like so many other Vietnamese, made her way back to her mostly destroyed village to begin her life again. The assault on Tan Son Hamlet was part of a concerted U.S. effort to pacify Binh Dinh, a region with a long history of fierce resistance to the French occupation. The campaign began with the 1st Cavalry Division's Operation Masher, though its name struck President Johnson as so inflammatory that the softer White Wing was soon tacked onto it, as if one somehow canceled out the other. During the 6 weeks of Masher White Wing, from late January to early March 1966, the 1st Cavalry Division fired 133,191 artillery rounds into Binh Dinh's heavily populated An Lao Valley and Bon Son Plain. The Navy added 3,213 rounds from its ships. The Air Force launched 600 tactical air sorties, dropping more than 427 tons of general-purpose bombs, 265 tons of fragmentation ordnance, 165 tons of napalm, and 80 tons of white phosphorus, which damaged or destroyed more than 600 huts and other structures. Of course, troops on the ground also laid waste to many other homes at the same time. One correspondent described the results in a village in An Lao Valley. More than half the huts were burned down, and the rice fields were pockmarked with bomb craters. The villagers assembled as the Americans marched in. They sat silently in front of their ruined huts. Women held crying children in their arms. When a young American tried to comfort a child, it began screaming, while the mother stared in terror at the foreign white giant. Allied efforts yielded an estimated 5,576 enemy casualties and a suspiciously low 354 personal weapons, even though the Americans took more than 600 prisoners, some presumably armed. In the process, noted the reporter and historian Francis Fitzgerald, U.S. and South Vietnamese forces left hundreds of civilians dead and wounded and generated so many refugees as almost to depopulate the fertile An Lao Valley. As operations in Binh Dinh continued, scenes of suffering like those at Tan Son played out over and over again throughout the province. In early 1966, for instance, Giao Hu and 15 nearby hamlets were ravaged by artillery fire and airstrikes during 1 3-week span. In just 3 of those hamlets, approximately 1,000 homes were blown apart by bombs and shells or reduced to cinder by napalm, leaving the hamlets, rice paddies, and surrounding hills scorched and pockmarked with craters. Additionally, shelling from U.S. Navy ships destroyed hundreds of coconut trees, the economic lifeblood of the region. The area around Tam Quan, just south of Giao Hu, was also pummeled by the same offensive, with an estimated 100 civilians killed there and hundreds more injured in just a few weeks. Afterward, survivors were showered with leaflets saying that the Viet Cong were responsible for the destruction since they had dug trenches and bunkers within the hamlets. The Americans' dedication to driving villagers out of their hamlets in Binh Dinh province was often not accompanied by much concern for what happened to the villagers who were driven out. In March 1967, for instance, members of Company A, 8th Engineer Battalion of the 1st Cavalry Division, joined a platoon from the 1st Battalion, 8th Cavalry, on a search-and-destroy mission in the province's Hoai Nhon district. The engineers blew up the family-style bomb shelters that the remaining locals were using for protection, destroying the village in the process. Left homeless and with nowhere to go, 12 civilians from the village, 8 women, 2 teenage girls, and 2 men over 50 years old, walked along with the patrol back to the American command post, but were soon sent away. That same afternoon, an unarmed man and a woman were spotted walking in a nearby rice paddy. From his post, one of the Company A engineers, Private First Class Richard Clark, watched the 8th Cavalry infantrymen unleash a fusillade at them. He saw the 2 Vietnamese fall to the ground and start crawling away as a platoon of cavalry troops swept toward them. Then he heard the firing of rifles, machine guns, and grenade launchers. The next day, Clark was part of a patrol that set out in the same direction. "We passed within 50 feet of numerous bodies," he said, "at least 4 of which I could identify as the people we'd taken out of the village the day before." Matthew Brennan of the 1st Cavalry recalled how his unit helped transform Binh Dinh from a paradise into an artillery-blasted and bomb-cratered wasteland. The soldiers, he wrote, would search deserted villages, many of which had beige stucco Catholic churches crowned by the one true cross, and burn every standing structure. Huts and haystacks were set aflame. Rice caches were soaked with aviation fuel and burned. On some days, we would burn so much rice and so many huts that in the evening our day's route would be marked by dozens of columns of rising white smoke, extending back across some silent valley or another. By May 1968, official U.S. statistics put the number of refugees in Binh Dinh at over 180,000. Those who warned that this policy was counterproductive were utterly ignored. "It is a mistake," declared Lieutenant Colonel Nguyen Bê, who had served as the Republic of Vietnam's deputy province chief, "to move the people off their hallowed land. This is a political war, and it must be fought by trained counter-guerrillas and political cadres, not by massive, impersonal free-strike zone bombings from the air. If we move the people from the land, we will surely lose their support. They will resent us." Nguyen Bê was right. When a sample of the province's refugees were surveyed in 1969, a clear majority blamed U.S. and Allied forces for destroying their villages and worsening their lives. Years later, the New York Times correspondent Gloria Emerson summed up the results of the American efforts. Despite the American occupation, she wrote, Binh Dinh never became a place they could overwhelm and change to be what they wanted. The number of dead Vietnamese and the refugees grew. Binh Dinh was never pacified.